This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Today, the United States and Russia are announcing a plan which we hope will reduce violence, ease suffering, and resume movement towards a negotiated peace and a political transition in Syria.
Earlier this month, the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov announced a landmark ceasefire in Syria involving unprecedented American-Russian cooperation. Barely 10 days later, that deal has apparently disintegrated. Russia has been blamed for an attack on an aid convoy on Monday, leaving at least 20 people dead. That followed the bombing of Assad's troops last weekend by the United States, for which the US has apologized. This was the second attempt at securing a ceasefire this year. But in a conflict involving a stubborn regime fighting dozens of opposition groups, and with a myriad of international players in the mix too, how is peace to be found in Syria? Step with me into the briefing room, where I'll be talking to people with direct experience in trying to find a resolution. In Washington, D.C., we have two guests.
This is Fred Hoff. I'm the director of the Rafiq Hariri Center of the Atlantic Council and previously served as chief U.S. negotiator for Syrian-Israeli peace and as an advisor to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on political transition in Syria.
And I'm Charles Lister. I'm a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute here in Washington, D.C., and the author of The Syrian Jihad.
And also joining me from our Manchester studio,
Yasmin Nahlawi, advocacy and policy coordinator of Rethink Rebuild Society and academic of international law.
Okay, thanks very much. Now, Charles Lister, let me start with you. Just to very briefly explain the current deal ceasefire. Who was it between and what was agreed?
Well, this is a deal that has come out of several months of sustained and fairly secretive negotiations between the United States and Russia. Generally speaking, the approach was to find a pathway towards an eventual political settlement for Syria, but more immediately to find a way towards establishing some kind of calm on the ground and to provide an opportunity for both the United States and Russia potentially to coordinate strikes against terrorist groups on the ground.
And what is the status of the deal now?
I mean, the deal as it is currently in a state of limbo. I think what we've really seen over the last week is a steady degradation of the so-called cessation of hostilities or ceasefire. And certainly the incidents that you mentioned at the beginning of the programme really put a severe dagger into the agreement as a whole. An integral part of an agreement that I should say is we were supposed to see at least 7 days of ceasefire and calm on the ground and the free flow of humanitarian aid to besieged communities across Syria before the United States and Russia would consider forming what they've called the Joint Implementation Group to coordinate counter-terrorism airstrikes across the country. So really, practically speaking, we haven't actually seen that first phase of the agreement met yet.
Fred Hoff, this was the second attempt at a ceasefire this year. There were previous attempts in 2012 and 2014. Is there a common ground that links their failure?
I believe that the absence of an or else the absence of what some people refer to as a plan B is essential. John Kerry is out there doing his best on the basis of his personal persuasive powers, his logic, his charisma. Those personal characteristics just are not enough. What he's needed is the ability to tell his Russian counterpart, if this doesn't work, Sergei Lavrov, X, Y, and Z are going to happen. He's not been empowered by the president to make that kind of presentation.
Yasmin Nakhlaoui, what were your expectations of this ceasefire?
I would echo much of what Ambassador Hoff said. We were cautiously optimistic when they announced the ceasefire. It comes on the back of many other failures in Syria, whether it's the one in February 2016 or the ones before it. And as the ambassador mentioned, it comes down to a lack of enforcement. It's not necessarily the terms that people have a problem with or that makes us, skeptical of whether or not it will work, but it's what happens when the parties fail to adhere to the terms of the ceasefire.
Okay, well, let's step back a moment. The origins of the Syrian civil war lie in the Arab Spring, and while other revolutions have come and gone with mixed fortunes for the countries involved, the war in Syria still rages 5 years on. So what's so different about this conflict? I've been speaking to Chris Phillips, a senior lecturer in international relations at Queen Mary University of London, and author of a recent book, The Battle for Syria.
A lot of research has been done on this subject matter. Most people that have researched this say that civil wars that are balanced between two sides will eventually exhaust themselves when both sides begin to realise that they're not going to achieve any of their goals by continuing to fight. You get a level of exhaustion whereby they're willing to consider negotiation.
What do we mean by a level of exhaustion?
Whereby they can't keep putting troops into the field, whereby they can't keep paying salaries, whereby their infrastructures and their state facilities begin to collapse. The difficulty is, of course, if external actors come in and provide troops, weaponry, financial support that mean that actually those internal actors don't get exhausted. And then they can keep fighting, not quite indefinitely, but for far longer. And then the question becomes how much intervention is going on each side. If you get what's called a decisive intervention, whereby one side intervenes far more heavily than the other side, then perhaps the side they support will win and the war will end. But if you get what's called a balanced intervention, whereby both sides put in roughly the same amount, or at least not enough for one side to win, then wars in the past have gone on for a very long time.
So which one is Syria? Is it a possible decisive intervention or is it a balanced intervention?
Syria at the moment looks like the classic example of a balanced intervention. You have actors, states supporting the two sides of a civil war, but not enough for either side to decisively win.
And who are the main supporters of either side?
The two main external sponsors of the Assad regime are Russia and Iran. On the anti-Assad side, the principal external sponsors of the mainstream opposition are three regional powers, Saudi Arabia, Turkey and Qatar, as well as leading Western actors, primarily the United States, but also other actors like Britain and France.
So are any of these external actors making any real difference?
They are shifting the short-term situation of the war. So Russia's intervention, for example, in September 2015 was considerable. It looked at that point that the Assad regime was on the back foot. And once the Russians intervened, alongside a major injection of troops from the Iranians at the same time, that situation was reversed and the Assad regime went back on the front foot. They recaptured the city of Palmyra from ISIS and they were able to encircle rebel-held sections of Aleppo. However, that intervention has not changed the fundamental dynamics of the war, which is that Assad does not have sufficient means to reconquer the whole of Syria. In terms of the support for the rebels, you have a similar situation. They're receiving enough external support, particularly from Saudi Arabia, Turkey and the United States these days, in order to keep fighting and to stay in the field, but certainly not enough to seriously challenge Assad or even contemplate defeating him militarily. So we have a stalemate.
So we have an intervention from outside that is now cancelling each other out, effectively. Is that right?
Yes, a balanced intervention.
Now, one of the things that you said right at the beginning of our discussion was the idea of civil wars ending when people are hurting enough. Mm-hmm. How can this not be hurting enough?
Well, they are hurting, but if the war is to reach an exhaustion point, the external actors that are contributing to this war need to reach exhaustion point as well. This war can run and run and run before we reach that level of exhaustion.
Dr. Chris Phillips from Queen Mary University of London. Fred Hoff, you were formerly Hillary Clinton's advisor on Syria when she was Secretary of State. Why do you think none of the foreign players have fully committed to tip the scales of balance in this war?
I think that Russia and Iran have made an attempt to tip the scales decisively. Certainly, Russia intervened militarily beginning on September 30th, 2015. Iran has been involved in this war from the beginning, providing advisory and assistance services to the Assad regime, bringing in Shia militiamen from all over the region. They both share, the Russians and the Iranians, even though their interests may be a little bit different, I think what they share is a determination that Bashar al-Assad will survive in power in at least part of Syria, at least part of Syria. This is very, very, very important to both sides. And, you know, if you look at the other side, if you look at the United States in particular, there is simply not as strong a motivation to see Assad gone. Certainly, it's the preference of President Obama, Secretary Kerry, and the rest that Assad be gone. But the Russians and the Iranians have been the ones who have really, really, really put their chips on the table.
Charles Lister, there is, of course, another player in this war which we haven't mentioned yet, and that is the jihadi groups operating in Syria, sometimes together with the opposition. Could you explain how that adds another layer of complication to any negotiation?
Yeah, well, I mean, generally speaking, in Syria, we have two key jihadi components, or Sunni jihadi components, I should say. The first one is the so-called Islamic State, which actually operates largely in isolation from the broader conflict between the opposition and its various backers. But the more important component to add here is al-Qaeda, who until very recently have had a de facto affiliate on the ground. His name originally was Jabhat al-Nusra. It has since rebranded itself. But this organization has spent a considerable amount of time, roughly 4 years, very consciously embedding itself within the broader opposition revolutionary movement. That complicates political efforts to solve the conflict because this group specifically wants no involvement in international politics whatsoever. And then probably more importantly, it acts as a spoiler on the ground by coercing and encouraging other more mainstream Syrian opposition groups from engaging in the political process constructively and instead choosing to initiate hostilities. And that's what we saw earlier this year with the first attempt at what was called a cessation of hostilities, which lasted, a fairly significant number of weeks. But after a certain period of time, this de facto al-Qaeda affiliate essentially convinced the majority of the armed opposition across northern Syria to reinitiate hostilities by making the argument that the international attempts to solve the Syrian crisis through politics was never going to succeed. And that has proven an extremely significant obstacle for the United States and indeed for Russia and the rest of the international community to get past.
Yasmin Nahrawi, you know quite a lot about the Syrian opposition groups, the non-jihadis. That's a problem for some of them, isn't it? That they seem to be in bed with groups like al-Nusra, which is a very big problem for supporters like the United States.
You know, when you ask Syrians on the ground or when you talk to Syrians and mention the issue of terrorist groups, many of them will simply find it ludicrous that, you know, for them, they're being bombed day in and day out by the Assad regime. It's really not their priority at this point. So for us or for Syrians, what's important is that you stop the attacks that are coming from the sky. And then after you get rid of this primary issue, then you can address the issue of radicalization on the ground. Until we save Syrians from air attacks, then it's going to be a lot more difficult to get their cooperation in combating these terrorist groups on the ground, not because they don't want to, but simply because they can't. And what I'd do is I'd point to 2014, when the moderate Syrian armed opposition groups were able to drive out ISIS from all of Syria, except for parts in Deir ez-Zor. They were able to drive them out within the span of 6 weeks. But what happened after that was the Assad regime started bombarding these same moderate armed opposition groups that are backed by us as the West. And ISIS was able to come back into Syria and to regain control.
I also want to understand more about the complexities of the negotiating process itself and how you can go about building trust and finding compromise for any kind of deal to be made. And Fred Hoff, I presume another complicating factor is that the different external actors just simply want different things from this war.
They do. Probably the high point diplomatically in all of this took place back in June 2012 at Geneva, when the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, Russia, the United States, Great Britain, France, and China, all agreed on a process whereby a transitional governing body, an interim government for Syria, would be created through negotiations between the Syrian government and the Syrian opposition. Unfortunately, that has not been carried forward. The Russians have backed away from it. It remains the essence of the possibility of negotiations. But right now, neither side, especially Russia, is dedicated to this particular procedure because it amounts in the end to peaceful, consensual regime change.
Charles Lister, can we just very briefly touch on Iran?
Yeah, Iran is almost a sort of hidden angle here. I mean, what's been interesting and perhaps also concerning with regards to the recent negotiations between the US and Russia was that Iran was entirely excluded from those talks. I would actually probably argue that Iran, in many respects, is a more important driver of conflict dynamics on the ground than Russia is. I mean, ultimately speaking, Russia has a small amount of special forces personnel who are deployed on the ground inside Syria. But Iran is arguably in control of, and if not in influence over, tens of thousands of Shia militiamen across the country who are playing a defensive and, more importantly, an offensive role on behalf of the Assad regime. So it was quite surprising that Iran was basically playing no role in the recent negotiations. And I think there's an extent to which Iran, and in fact Russia, no one actually knows exactly what these countries' red lines are. Where are they willing to concede? What are they willing to ultimately accept? I think Iran certainly takes a much harder line in terms of the survival of the Assad regime. But there's been talk for a long time that Russia is by no means sold on Bashar al-Assad's long-term survival. But no one quite knows what that means.
Fred Hoff, you've personally met with President Assad, who is going to be key to this in one way or another. Do you think he's remotely interested in negotiation now?
Apparently not. I am seeing absolutely no indication of interest. I think President Assad, his family, his entourage have, in essence, a 20-year plan for reconquering Syria. Assad is quite willing to fight to the last Russian, the last Iranian, the last Shia militiaman to accomplish his goal. And I think that Assad is palpably relieved that current ceasefire efforts seem to have collapsed.
Charles Lister, you've been involved in what is termed track two diplomacy, more informal talks, often with unofficial sources and non-state actors. So you speak to opposition groups in Syria, I think, on a daily basis. When you speak to people in an informal way, is there any movement on the demand that Assad would have to go immediately for there to be any long-term deal?
When I started doing these talks roughly 3 years ago, the opposition established line was that President Assad had to leave power before negotiations started. So in other words, Assad would leave power and then negotiations would start with what remained of the state in Damascus and other cities under his previous control and the opposition. And what has been interesting is as the conflict has lasted, as the death toll has risen, as the destruction has continued, the opposition's red line has steadily shifted. Now there is undoubtedly a recognition that there needs to be negotiations with President Assad and his various, you know, regime inner circle around a table. And there are, although it's rare to hear armed opposition groups make this position in public, there are many armed opposition groups who in private, in front of special envoys from the United States and other countries, who are willing to say that they would potentially consider President Assad remaining in power for perhaps a period of 6 months, maybe even 12 months, if and only if such an agreement was specifically guaranteed, for example, by a UN Security Council resolution signed also by Russia and China, and if there were specific guarantees that they were willing to trust that would ensure Assad would depart after those 6 or 12 months. But fundamentally speaking, all of this is kind of, you know, theoretical and in many ways impractical until the Assad regime is even willing to negotiate. And we still haven't reached that point yet.
Yasmin Nahrawi, how do you react to what you've just heard?
It's one thing to say that the U.S. and Russia can make their negotiations and their deals and make their own decisions. But the fact of the matter is that this is all, we're ultimately talking about Syria, and the people who are going to decide the future of Syria have to be Syrians. And if we get to a scenario where a solution is imposed on people, you know, what we'd be doing is what we've done in many other countries historically, is just put the bottle cap back on the bottle, which is going to explode 5-10 years down the line. If we want these talks to succeed, and if we want to build a country that reflects what Syrians want, they have to be at the forefront in all of these processes.
Let's try and be positive and to resurrect the phrase confidence building that I seem to remember from previous, previous conflicts. I wonder what impact even a short period of peace would be on the conflict. Yasmin Nahlawi, your organisation is called Rethink, Rebuild Society. When we talk about Syrian society, it's as though it's all about men with guns, but somehow you get people reporting back from Syrian towns and society is staggering on, which means that there's a civil society in place. There are organisations. Does that civil society have some influence upon the actors?
Absolutely. There's a flourishing civil society in Syria despite the bleak circumstances. They, for example, provide medical services. They allocate food. So in Daraya, which was besieged, the food that they had, the local council would allocate the food and distribute it among the families. They set up an education system, a court system, so they're giving out birth and death certificates. They are democratic. So this dispels the idea that there can be no democracy in Syria. So these people on the ground have set up democratic systems across the country that are, given the limited circumstances and the daily bombardment that they face, they are still able to bring as much normalcy or as much order they can in a democratic way, which shows that the future of Syria actually can move forward that way.
Charles Lister, in practical terms, what role do you think civil society can play in Syria? Can there be some political pressure from these sorts of organisations?
Well, I think civil society does have an overarching impact in terms of the political positions of armed groups, for example. And if there's one thing I've learned from 3 years of pretty sustained engagement with the armed opposition in Syria, it's that they're intensely sensitive to what civil society around them is saying. And if civil society doesn't want them to be involved in political talks, these armed groups find it extremely difficult to justify being involved in them, and vice versa. And so undoubtedly civil society remains. I think the difficult thing or the challenging thing is that when conflict is so intense across Syria, civil society does kind of, it doesn't disappear, it doesn't stop working, but it's not as visible as it is, as Yasmin said again, as when there is a broader sense of calm in the country. And so that is precisely why efforts by the United States and its various allies have focused on establishing some sense of calm across the country as a precedent, as a preliminary stage before it potentially considering any actual political negotiations, because calm does bring out those better aspects of the opposition, those better aspects of the revolution that then empower more moderate visions for Syria's future.
Ambassador Fred Hoff, what is the missing link for progress to be found, to be made in finding peace in Syria?
Civilian protection. From my point of view, this is the absolute center of gravity. Without it, nothing good politically will happen in Syria. It is senseless to talk about peace negotiations. when one's constituents are being vaporized or scattered to the four winds. It just won't work. Until the United States, Russia, and other parties can arrive at arrangements, or until the United States begins to exact a price of those who are assaulting civilians on a daily basis, there is no hope for anything good politically happening in Syria.
Let's be absolutely clear what that missing link means. You mean that you get a ceasefire agreement that says people don't hit civilians, and if people do hit civilians, and you've already said it's mostly the Assad regime that does it, then in that case something gets done to them. Like what?
Yes, paying a price. The 51 dissenting diplomats in the U.S. Department of State, people who have been working on this problem for the last 5 years, recommended specifically to the president that the United States consider the use of cruise missiles, for example, to hit Syrian air bases. The key factor right now is that this mass slaughter takes place in an entirely cost-free environment. If the diplomacy fails, I think the United States is going to have to consider exacting a price in order to slow down this death spiral of Syria.
Implicit in what you said is a criticism that such measures have not so far been taken by the current president of the United States. Well, by January, we'll have a new president of the United States. So starting with the less likely at the moment, Donald Trump, what do we imagine that the consequences would be of that presidency?
If you're asking me, I have absolutely no idea what's going to come out of Trump.
I think I would second that.
I have no idea what's going to come out of Trump's foreign policy, if I'm quite frank with you, and I don't think anyone does. With regards to a potential Hillary Clinton presidency, I think there's a lot of hope. The challenge that potential President Clinton would face, however, is that by the time she's practically able to implement something genuinely new in Syria, we're realistically speaking about next summer, nearly a year from now. And the big question that remains there is, will there be anything for her to really deal with a year from now? I mean, the situation really is as bad as it's ever been in Syria today. The extremist actors on all sides of the spectrum, both pro-government and anti-government, are steadily rising in influence. And that's the point I try to make these days, is really time is of the essence, and it's not really practical to speak necessarily about waiting for a new president here in Washington.
Fred Hoff, you were Hillary Clinton's ambassador.
Well, I think that in the case of Secretary Clinton, if she's elected, she will indeed turn to her Secretary of Defense and ask in a very positive, assertive way for options to mitigate the civilian slaughter. We still have upwards of 4 months left to the Obama administration. John Kerry has said publicly that the alternative to his plan working is for the United States to sit and watch as civilian slaughter resumes. This is not a good alternative, and I hope that President Obama, in the time left to him, will take a second look at this.
Well, thank you all very much. That's all we have time for this week. I mean, to sum that up, everybody here around the table seems to agree that it is only when, effectively, civilians can be protected from significant attack that, firstly, a ceasefire can hold, and secondly, that any meaningful attempts at a peace agreement can be made. My thanks to Ambassador Fred Hoff of the Atlantic Council, Charles Lister from the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., and Yasmin Nakhlawi of the Rethink Rebuild Society Syrian Advocacy Group in Manchester. Till next week, good night.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.